Hello, this is Beatrice Pavio with part one of the pantograph of Friday, April 3rd, 2026. We turn first to page one, where the main story is about the workforce, titled Rivian Workers Say, Where is the Union? Absent UAW and company blamed for stalled unionization effort. This story is datelined Normal. A group of Rivian automotive workers in Normal say their multi-year effort to unionize has been at a stalemate, not only because of the company, but due to what they describe as a lack of transparency and support from the United Auto Workers. Workers who spoke to the pantograph said organizing efforts that once showed momentum have slowed significantly over the last year, with fewer meetings, limited communication, and little clarity about the path forward. "Either help us or let us go," said Jeffrey Schaefer, who works along the automotive trim line in General Assembly at Rivian, "because right now nothing is happening." In an email Thursday, Kelly Felker, Rivian's senior manager of corporate communications, said, "Rivian is focused on maintaining a culture where we respect, communicate with, and reward our employees as individuals. We are building a self-sustaining business. We are on the path to get there together with our employees." According to a statement from the Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity, the state is aware of these discussions and believe they are best addressed directly by the parties involved, consistent with state and federal laws and the collective bargaining process. Schaefer, 59, and fellow Rivian workers Renee Leonard, 43, and Eric Wirt, 49, said organizing efforts at the Normal manufacturing plant date back a handful of years, with the three getting involved as early as 2022. Early on, the meetings were held informally and focused broadly on workplace concerns, before becoming more structured by late 2023, when organizers collected union authorization cards as part of a broader UAW push to organize non-union auto plants. Momentum increased in spring 2024 after worker-led events drew wider interest and participation. Additional UAW organizers came to the plant, and there was a focus on broader outreach into the Bloomington Normal community. "We were gaining traction," said Leonard, who works along the door line in General Assembly at Rivian. "We, as organizing committee members, were working hard to get people to sign their cards and to educate them." But that traction began to slip in late 2024 when communication between the local organizers and the UAW representatives became inconsistent, she said. Meetings that had previously been held regularly at least twice a month started to taper off, and workers stopped receiving key metrics, including how many employees had signed union cards and what steps were needed next. "It was all these little things where it felt like they were putting the brakes on, and we started questioning," Leonard said. "Nobody wanted to give us any answers." The UAW did not respond to multiple requests for comment from the pantograph. In late 2024, workers compiled testimony and documentation related to workplace concerns, including allegations of harassment, and worked with local labor leaders and state officials to draft a letter to the governor's office, the three Rivian workers said in a recent interview. The letter was completed in November 2024, but not sent until spring 2025, after workers took a vote and pushed union representatives to act. As part of what workers understood to be an agreement between Rivian and the UAW, employees formed a committee to raise workplace concerns in meetings with the company. Schaefer said only two such meetings have occurred, one in spring 2025 and another last month, despite their expectation of quarterly discussions. Another source of confusion for workers involved in unionizing discussion is whether a neutrality agreement exists between Rivian and the UAW. A neutrality agreement is typically meant to prevent employer interference in union organizing. Bloomberg reported on December 19, 2024, the UAW had reached an agreement with Rivian, but the neutrality commitment would only take effect once the plant becomes profitable. The neutrality agreement also was reported as helping to make possible a conditional loan of $6.6 billion from the U.S. Energy Department back in January 2024 to help build Rivian's new plant in Georgia, according to Bloomberg's article. Schaefer said the organizing campaign had already slowed down midway through 2025, with infrequent or canceled meetings and a UAW representative going on leave without a replacement being assigned for months. Leonard and the others continue to organize independently by addressing workplace concerns, communicating with coworkers, and holding meetings, sometimes even at their own homes, but they still lacked the support and transparency needed to move forward, they said. It's about our coworkers who come to us saying, "I signed my card a year ago. What is going on?" Leonard said. Schaefer said he also reached out to the regional and international offices of the UAW, as well as members of Rivian's executive leadership team, including CEO R.J. Scaringe. Frustrated with the lack of response and progress, Schaefer reached out to other local unions for advice and support with the ongoing issues. "We're just hitting a wall here. We can't seem to really get going on anything," Schaefer said. Local labor advocate Mike Matika said the Bloomington Normal Trades and Labor Assembly is the central labor council for unions in the community, and its members support workers who want to organize, but the assembly does not direct campaigns. Early on, UAW representatives attended the local trades and labor meetings, but over the last 2 years, it has mostly been Rivian workers themselves showing up, Matika said. "One of the contentions that we're hearing from the workers at Rivian is, if there's dialogue with the UAW and Rivian, they, the workers, want to be in the room," he said. Jason Pascal, president of LIUNA 362, said the organizational shift of the UAW representative may have contributed to the disruption, but there are also organizing differences between industrial unionization and something like construction. In construction, Pascal said unions can negotiate directly with employers, while in industrial settings, unions need worker support before engaging with management. "The more transparency, especially as you're developing a new contract like that, you want the membership to trust and have faith in you, then you're probably going to involve them more," Pascal said. Other factors play into organizing in an industrial setting like Rivian, including multiple shifts, various departments, and a large workforce that is spread across a massive campus. To even request an election with the National Labor Relations Board, Schaefer said the plant organizers at Rivian would need at least 50% of workers to sign union authorization cards, but for a vote to pass, they would likely want more in the realm of 75% of workers. "Part of the problem is not only being able to advocate and get cards signed across the plant, but also knowing how many employees currently work at the plant to understand the number needed to start the vote. In the last 2 years, Rivian has stopped releasing the number of employees who work at each of the company's locations. Instead, it has only reported global staffing, which currently sits at 15,232 employees. During a recent stop in Bloomington, Governor J.B. Pritzker estimated Rivian employs 8,000 people in Illinois, but he called that estimate a vague idea. The Rivian plant had about 7,000 assembly workers in April 2024 when it moved from 3 shifts to 2. Schaefer said the workers could not give an exact employee count either. But their concerns about safety, workplace injuries, and scheduling practices remain unresolved despite the ongoing organizing efforts, he said. Leonard described unpredictable shift changes and physically demanding work conditions that can take a toll on one's body. "It's been so frustrating because we have been trying to get going and just make it so people can go to work, come home, and have a life, and it's not happening," Schaefer said. And our next front page story is about McLean County, titled Gala Honors Mentors Who Make History. Dateline, Bloomington. The 2026 class of McLean County History Makers has been announced, and despite their diverse backgrounds and expertise, they all appear to share one unique attribute. The one common thread that you'll see through all of their bios is a bend towards mentoring and counseling, said Norris Porter, Assistant Executive Director and Development Director at the McLean County Museum of History. That's pretty special to think that not only have they done great things, but they have also affected the lives and experiences of many other people and generations of individuals. Porter announced on Wednesday three individuals and one couple were selected for the honor: Melinda Fisher, John McIntyre, Feli Sebastian, and Camille and Art Taylor, and they will be honored June 17th at the 2026 History Makers Gala. Tickets for the gala, which doubles as the McLean County Historical Society's annual meeting, are available online or in person at the museum, located at 200 North Main Street in downtown Bloomington. The price is $100 for the general public and $75 for museum members. All proceeds from tickets and sponsorships fund the museum's education programs. Melinda Fisher. Being recognized as such is quite an honor, said Fisher, who spent decades coaching teams at Illinois State University. I mean, just listening to the readings about everybody else, I'm not sure I belong here, she added with a laugh. Fisher was born and raised in Pekin and attended ISU from 1968 to 1972. She was accomplished in many sports, including taking the softball team to the first ever Women's College World Series in 1969. After college, she started coaching at Eastern Illinois University before returning to Normal in 1980. She served as an assistant coach for basketball and softball before taking over head coaching duties for the softball team in 1986. Fisher retired from coaching in 2022. She earned the most wins of any coach in Illinois State University history, with 1,159 victories coaching women's softball, 1,118 of those at ISU, according to the university. That also makes her the winningest coach in Missouri Valley Conference history, according to the History Museum. Fisher led the Redbirds to 10 MVC titles and 5 MVC tournament titles, and she ranks number 18 on the list of all-time wins for coaches in the NCAA Division I softball. ISU will be renaming the softball field in Fisher's honor in a ceremony on April 11th. John McIntyre. It's pretty humbling for me because there are so many good people that I worked with in this community, said McIntyre, former chair of the McLean County Board and longtime teacher and coach. McIntyre grew up in Farmer City, helping his father as a gas station attendant. After he graduated from high school in 1961, he went on to study at both ISU and Illinois Wesleyan University. He was elected to the McLean County Board in 1980, and he chaired several committees, including Health, Human Services, and Recreation, before leaving the board in 1988. McIntyre returned to public service after he retired and found himself back on the county board in 2008. He championed the preservation of McLean County Nursing Home and led the county's Mental Health Action Plan. For this work, President Barack Obama invited him to Washington, D.C., where McIntyre presented to Congress on mental health and social services programs. Besides serving on the county board for over 20 total years, McIntyre has also been inducted into several local sports halls of fame, including those of the High School Football Coaches Association, Central Catholic High School, and the Bloomington Normal Officials Association. Feli Sebastian, it's very humbling that the museum is able to recognize the things that I do for the community, specifically for the women, Sebastian said. Sebastian was born in the Philippines, where she earned a bachelor's degree in history and a master's degree in counseling. She taught grade school beginning in 1975 before moving to the U.S. in the 1980s and joining the Franciscan Sisters Convent in Ohio. In 1989, she received her doctorate in clinical psychology and began practicing in Bloomington at what was then known as Broman Hospital. In 1997, she opened her own private practice. In 2011, Sebastian helped start the Labyrinth House to help formerly incarcerated women re-enter society, providing them a support system and help finding an employment and housing. In 2016, Labyrinth was absorbed into YWCA McLean County. Sebastian also teamed up with fellow history maker Mary Campbell to start Dreams Are Possible, a program that equips women with necessary skills and confidence to secure higher-paying jobs. Currently, Sebastian is the co-chair of the Extraordinary Women Project of BN, uplifting the voices and stories of women who are quietly making a difference in people's lives. Camille and Art Taylor. "It is a true honor," Art Taylor said, of being named a history maker. His wife, though, had jokes. "First of all, it means you're old," she said with a laugh. "And then that means you're old enough to have had the opportunity to contribute to things in the county and in the community." However, Art and Camille Taylor were quick to note they do not seek accolades for their work, which includes advocating for fairness, justice, and human rights. "You don't do things in the community for the recognition of it," Art Taylor said. "And that's why the recognition and the honor of just being out there and people observing what it is that you try to do to make the community better is such an honor." "It's the old adage, to whom much is given, much is expected," Camille Taylor added. "Everybody has a gift, so you try to use the gift that you have to make things better, to help people." Despite meeting as high schoolers at St. Anselm's Catholic Church in Chicago, Camille and Art Taylor had very different paths to Bloomington Normal and eventually marriage. Camille Taylor attended ISU in 1975 and began advocating for low-income students while on the university's Child Care Advisory Board. She graduated with a degree in special education and began working at McLean County Unit 5 in Normal. She spent 34 years as an educator, serving as a special education teacher, a counselor, and a life skills teacher. In 2000, when Camille Taylor joined the staff at Normal Community High School, she was the only Black counselor in the district. Because of this, she spearheaded a district-wide diversity awareness program for both staff and students. While she was there, Camille Taylor also championed diverse and inclusive student organizations. Beyond her work in and around the classroom, Camille Taylor has been a member of the board of directors for the YWCA McLean County. She serves the League of Women Voters and is co-chair of Not in Our Town and Not in Our Schools. Art Taylor left Chicago in 1970 when his father received a leadership position at Quaker Oats in Jackson, Tennessee. He attended Lambeth College in Jackson on a full basketball scholarship. But he never played in a game after a severe injury to his left ankle left him unable to jump off that foot, he said. However, the school honored his scholarship and funded his education. Art Taylor remained involved with the basketball team, but he also began using his voice to speak out as an activist. That included pressuring the college to remove from classrooms a history textbook that promoted the Lost Cause narrative of the Civil War and praised the Confederacy. After graduating in 1976, Art Taylor began a 20-year career in retail, which brought him to Bloomington, and he and Camille reconnected and married in 1994. In 2017, the City of Bloomington established its Public Safety and Community Review Board, with Art Taylor as its first chair. And our last front page story is about the Justice Department headlined, "Bondi Out as Attorney General, Trump Loyalty and Epstein Files Shaped Tenure." This is an Associated Press story datelined Washington. President Donald Trump said Thursday that Pam Bondi is out as his Attorney General, ending the contentious tenure of a loyalist who upended the Justice Department's culture of independence from the White House, oversaw large-scale firings of career employees, and moved aggressively to investigate the Republican president's perceived enemies. The announcement follows months of scrutiny over the Justice Department's handling of files related to Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking investigation that made Bondi the target of angry conservatives, even with her close relationship with Trump. She also struggled to satisfy Trump's demands to prosecute his political rivals, with multiple investigations rejected by judges or grand juries or yet to produce charges. Trump named Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche as the acting Attorney General, though three people familiar with the matter have said that he has privately discussed Lee Zeldin, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, as a permanent pick. Bondi, a former Florida Attorney General, came into office last year, pledging that she would not play politics with the Justice Department, but she quickly started investigations of Trump foes, sparking an outcry that the law enforcement agency was being wielded as a tool of revenge to advance the president's political and personal agenda. She ushered in a period of intense turmoil at the department that included the firings of career prosecutors deemed insufficiently loyal to Trump and the resignations of hundreds of other employees. Her departure continues a trend of Justice Department upheaval that has defined Trump's presidency, as multiple attorney generals across his two terms have either been pushed out or resigned after proving unwilling or unable to meet his demands for the position. Bondi rejected accusations that she politicized the Justice Department and said her mission was to restore the institution's credibility after overreach by President Joe Biden's Democratic administration with two federal criminal cases against Trump. Bondi's defenders have said she worked to refocus the department to better tackle illegal immigration and violent crime and brought much-needed change to an agency they believe unfairly targeted conservatives. Bondi's public embrace of the president, however, marked a sharp departure from her predecessors, who generally took pains to maintain an arm's-length distance from the White House to protect the impartiality of investigations and prosecutions. Bondi postured herself as Trump's chief supporter and protector, praising and defending him in congressional hearings and placing a banner with his face on the exterior of Justice Department headquarters. And we move now to some local and state news. NPD to target distracted driving. The Normal Police Department is increasing patrols in recognition of Distracted Drivers Awareness Month with federal traffic safety funds administered by the Illinois Department of Transportation. NPD is teaming up with Illinois State Police and local law enforcement agencies across the state throughout the month of April to identify and stop distracted driving. Violations can include texting, social media use, video viewing, and other electronic device use behind the wheel, according to a news release from the department. It is illegal in Illinois to use a cell phone or any other handheld electronic communication device while driving, and agencies are implementing a zero-tolerance policy throughout the enforcement campaign, according to the release. Drivers are encouraged to pull over and put the car in park before using their devices for calls, text messages, video calls, checking directions, or any other use of these devices. The Normal Police Department encourages all motorists to stay alert, keep their hands on the wheel, eyes on the road, and minds on driving. Making the simple choice to avoid distractions can save lives, the department said in the release. And this story is headlined, 13 graduate from Ag Leader Program, Dateline Bloomington. 13 Illinois Farm Bureau members and agricultural professionals recently graduated from the Agricultural Leaders of Tomorrow program. The program is designed to help participants develop leadership and advocacy skills. The 2026 graduating class represented 10 Illinois counties, including 5 full-time farmers, 4 part-time farmers, and participants from other agriculture-related industries. 4 of those graduates are from McLean, Tazewell, and LaSalle counties. Olivia Kragland of McLean County is a student at Heartland Community College pursuing requirements needed to enter the agricultural safety sector and plans to help reduce and prevent major accidents. He served in the Marine Corps after graduating high school and then transitioned into agriculture pursuing grain elevator operations. In 2022, Oliver Kragland survived a severe accident inside a grain bin, which resulted in amputation and motivated him to change career paths to agriculture safety advocacy and risk prevention. Matt Miller of McLean County joined Country Financial in 2011 and currently serves as the Crop Underwriting Operations Manager, overseeing day-to-day operations of crop underwriting, compliance, training, systems, and product development. He is a 2023 graduate of the Crop Insurance and Reinsurance Bureau Emerging Leader Program and holds an agricultural Yellow Belt certification. Prior to his current role, he held various positions in crop underwriting and crop claims. He earned a bachelor's degree in business administration from Benedictine University in Springfield. Chase Oxner of LaSalle County grew up in Ottawa and received his bachelor's degree in economics from Illinois Wesleyan University and a master's degree in economics at Texas A&M. He originally focused on labor and financial economics, but later became drawn to agricultural economics for its practicality and direct application to real-world challenges, according to a news release. He did not grow up on a farm, but was inspired by his grandfather, who farmed and passed down values of hard work, humility, and perseverance, which he uses in both his personal and professional life. Mally Piles of Tazewell County currently serves as an agribusiness insurance operations supervisor at Country Financial, leading process improvement initiatives and supports operational team efficiency. Other recipients included Emily Clare of Champaign County, Aaron DeGroot of Christian County, Ed Dubrick of Iroquois County, Michael Gill, Peoria County, Brian Grotfent and Nicholas Javillo, both of Madison County, James Marr of Peoria County, Zach Rinker of Shelby County, and Courtney Sandage of Mason County. And Hopedale Medical Complex recently announced the winners of their Doctor's Day coloring contest. The contest is a collaboration between HMC and local students in first and second grade. Doctor's Day is celebrated March 30th to recognize the dedication and skills of doctors and their unwavering commitment to local communities, according to a news release. Over 350 entries were submitted from six school districts, as well as Miss Mona's Daycare. This year's winners each win a $25 gift card for their classroom and have their art on display at the complex. And here is today's Flick Fact question. In this crazy weather lately, 80 one day, 30 the next night, can you name the legendary McLean County business that's especially affected? And the answer is the folks who tap the sugar maples and produce the famously delicious Funk's Grove maple syrup. The trees, explains Debbie Funk, love the usual upper 20s to upper 40s when cold nights draw the sap up the tree. And then when the mercury hits the lower 50s, the sap begins to drip from the spouts. But once temperatures jump into the 70s or 80s, the tree buds expand, the chemistry changes, and the sap turns bitter. Season quickly over. The extreme temperature swings, Debbie says, make syrup production much more of a challenge, especially the extreme highs that sometimes now occur in February and bring an early end to our season. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, April 3rd, 2026. I look forward to reading part two with you next.